Call this meeting to order. House file, what's up first? While we're waiting to figure out house file we got up first, we have minutes from March 24th. Chris, did you read those? Representative Swedinski? Read them, fully understand them? Okay. Anybody like to approve the minutes from March 24th?
I've got him here, Mr. Chair, and I will move the minutes from March 24th.
Representative Sanders approves, makes a motion to approve the minutes of March 24th. All in favor of that motion? Are there any corrections or additions to the minutes of March 24th? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of March 24th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. House File 1362, Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to ask that House File 1362 be passed and go on to the Ways and Means Committee. And I'd like to just briefly explain what this House File does. This is a bill that has come together through the Workers' Comp Advisory Board. And just to give you a little bit of background of what that board is, it's chaired here by our Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, Mr. Ken Peterson. And then we also have the head of the AFL-CIO, Cher Knutson, and the president of the Chamber of Commerce, David Olson. And then we also have some members on that advisory council from both labor and management. So for these groups, these stakeholders, to come up with a solution to streamline some processes with workers' comp and dispute resolution, we feel that this is a really good step in the right direction for workers and for businesses. Just briefly, Mr. Chair, I do have a couple of oral amendments.
Okay.
Do you want me to move those now?
Would you move those?
Okay.
And
if you look at line 10.5, we would like to change the effective date to August 1st, 2011. So I would recommend that we vote on this.
Does everybody understand the amendment? Any questions about that amendment? Seeing none? All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Passes.
Next. Thank you. And then a second oral amendment I'd like to introduce is it's a one-time appropriation for a case management system. And we originally did not have this in the bill because there was some money involved, but we find that this money will not be taken from general fund. It will be part of the workers' comp funds that they already work with. And I can have someone else kind of explain why we're doing this, but I think it has to do with streamlining a process and just being more efficient in our calendaring of items so we don't have multiple cases or things falling through the cracks. Are there any questions about this?
Oh, we have a page getting amendment right now, and they just had to get it copied.
Okay.
As soon as it gets passed out, we'll ask for questions. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, is the other member of this committee that's on the Work Comp Advisory Board, this had been discussed at the Work Comp Advisory Board. I don't know why it wasn't in the bill, and I'm going to take the commissioner and the bill author at face value. But it was discussed in the committee, and it is case management. I'm not a lawyer, as I said before. I only play one at the Capitol. But we have, and I'll speak to it a little later in the bill. But we do have some real serious issues with case management, and this is a step towards getting it better. So I'll be supporting the amendment.
Can I support the amendment as well? Are there any other questions about?
Well, everybody got a copy of the amendment?
No. We got 1396.
What?
Wrong one.
We need 1362.
Let's temporarily lay this bill over so we get the amendment copy.
Okay. Do you want me to, what would you like me to do next?
We will call you back up as soon as we get the amendment copy. We got it now? It's in the packet?
A2
amendment?
Mr. Chair, can we just withdraw that amendment then? And we'll
withdraw this amendment?
This
A2?
This one with the $600,000 special compensation fund for the purpose of implementing the case management.
Okay. We'll withdraw that amendment that we don't have copied, and
I guess the A2 amendment?
No. This is
we're all right. Okay. Okay, go ahead and continue talking about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Sorry about that confusion. A little bit of last-minute changes there. At this time, I've given my brief summary. I have Commissioner Peterson here from the Department of Labor and Industry if we have any other questions about the bill. And I also have a few people in the audience if we have any questions.
Any members have questions about the bill? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiefer, I don't have a question about the bill, but the amendment that we don't have, you said something about unemployment insurance fund, no? Or
no, I'm sorry if I did. I was okay. Wrong. It's workers' comp.
Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney.
And this, with this lull, as we're waiting for the amendment to be copied and handed out, maybe the commissioner could explain the problems that's going on with the calendar issue that has caused this $600,000 expenditure.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, we are withdrawing the bills. We will not be providing that amendment. We're withdrawing that amendment. We will not be providing that amendment today. We'll try to introduce this amendment at a later date somewhere else along the line. However, this bill is the bill overall is as Representative Kiefer had said, is a piece of the valley bill, and we both management and labor have worked very closely on this. We've had a number of hours of discussions on it. The big problem we've had with one of the problems we have with the workers' compensation system, as Representative Mahoney has pointed out, it takes a while to get disputes resolved. It's taken too long, and hopefully what this one does is speed that up in a number of ways, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to come back next year and give some good results for that. So that's the number one thing this does is just speed up the process to make sure that both the insurers, employers, as well as injured workers get answers quicker to their disputes. Sometimes one side's right, sometimes the other, but we all deserve a quicker resolution of their disputes. That's what this does.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
If they're done presenting the bill, if I may just educate the committee on a couple of things that I learned sitting on the advisory board. If you're an injured worker and you're appealing, because the lawyers say it takes this long, they have 120 days. To get you in front of their and they call it the adversarial doctor. So if I'm injured climbing a ladder and I appeal and I don't like the offering, the lawyer has 120 days, typically takes almost that long, to get me in front of an adversarial doctor. Frankly, I can call my general practitioner and get in within 48 hours. On top of that 120 days, they have 180 days to schedule a hearing. 300 days. 300 days for an injured worker and an employer to pay for that injured worker's upkeep. Members, something has got to change at the workers' comp board. For employees to be stuck for 300 days, for employers to be stuck paying the bill for 300 days is absolutely ludicrous. It doesn't help our businesses in this state. It does not help our employees. And I would like the commissioner to understand and follow what I'm saying here. Although he has had his ear burned off by me once or twice, and the committee has had my their ears burned off, and that's just the start. I have letters in my office of people taking 2.5, 3 years to settlement for workers' comp injuries before they actually get to being retrained. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Commissioner Peterson, I think the board or the committee knows that I'm going to be like a pit bull chewing on your ankle to figure out a way to get injured workers served faster, quicker, and better. And unless you do something, unless that committee does something, this legislature will have to call that committee here to explain to us why they are taking a year or better for employees and employers to get served by the workers' compensation system. It's not your fault. You just came into this in the last 60 days or 90 days or whatever it is. Doesn't mean we shouldn't take a look and figure out a way to do it better. But I have to tell you, and I hope this committee understands, that no worker should be stuck standing still for at least a year. And it's not just the workers, it's the workers and the employers. So there, I've ranted for the day.
Commissioner Peterson, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I agree. Shouldn't take as long. We'll do the best we can. It'll get better. This will make some improvements, and we'll come up with more ideas, and we'll get faster and faster. I'm not sure. It won't be perfect. It'll get better. I promise that.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Now, we're talking 300 days. Now, what is the average? Is that the real wait? I mean, when we're talking, you know, just because in statute it states 180 days or 120 days, what has been the average?
Madam Chairman, Representative, it's hard to really figure. There are so many different types of disputes. It's hard to actually determine what an average is, because there are medical disputes, the rehabilitation disputes, there are disputes over indemnity, wage replacement. So it varies. One of the things we've done here is it takes 212 days on average to get to a settlement conference. That's average. We've shortened, we've said you can't take longer than 180 days to get to a settlement conference. We're making the maximum lower than the average today. So we are improving it. I wish I could. I've asked that same question about how long does it really take, but there's so many different types of disputes, it's hard to come up with an average that would really be, that would tell us anything. It'd just be deceptive. But I can tell you that there are different types of disputes. Some are pretty easy to resolve, others aren't. Medical ones are sometimes the most difficult, because it sometimes takes a while for an injury to really exhibit what the real problems are. And also, we do have a problem with doctors. Doctors don't particularly like workers' comp claims because it's under a different system. They're not working with the regular system. You know, they're not working with regular healthcare insurers. So it's a little different for them. And doctors would prefer to be treating patients as opposed to filling out forms. So they take longer than they would like. I'm not quite sure what to do with that, but we're going to have to address it.
Thank you. Representative Leidiger.
I just want to follow up, please, with a couple more questions. I tend to agree with Representative Mahoney on the settlement, the time for settlement. But I'm more concerned with we're not going to limit any treatment that a worker, that doesn't get delayed out to settlement. So that's being taken care of right away. I'm hoping that we're not messing with that. And what about pay? You know, is a worker able to get back on the payroll without a settlement, or do you have to settle first, or what about those kinds of issues?
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative, for the pay, it's going to vary upon the situation of the injured worker. If the reaction of the employer insurer. If they don't believe that it was an injury incurred while at work, they're not going to be paying indemnity benefits to them. They're going to be held up. And so they just say it was not a work-related injury. You got hurt playing softball. I don't know, whatever, whatever else it was. And so then the injured worker would not get it. So that's, those are the type of situations where you have to go to a hearing where the injured worker's got to show that she or he was actually hurt at work as opposed to hurt, was injured doing something else. So those are the ones that too often take too long. And that's what this bill would hope to do, is speed up the system to make it go faster so they can get a resolution quicker.
Representative Light.
I think you were here when I talked about my particular case. That took a long time, and there was a lot of controversy on that, and it does take a lot of time. So I think I'm okay with this. It puts it on fast track, and this is all coming from that council, right? So I'm okay with it. I've got to look at your amendment, though. Is this your amendment to this?
No. Later.
Sorry.
That's one coming up. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just actually have a related question. My understanding is some injured workers do not get the treatment they need because the employer denies that it's related to their work, and so if they don't have private insurance or they don't have another kind of insurance, they're not going to get the treatment. And I can cite a specific case dealing with a chemical injury that was just brought to my attention not too long ago.
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, that's true. If the employer says that it's not a work-related injury, then they will not get the medical care unless they have some private insurance that will take care of them in the meantime.
So, Representative Leidiger, I think it's really important to know that people are not getting the medical care they need when there's a dispute going forward that the employer says is not related to their job. Even though the evidence is there, I guess when talking about an injury that you can see visibly, a limb or something, I'm wondering if you can maybe tell us, if not today, what you're seeing in terms of some of these environmental health injuries where people are breathing fumes that cause major, breathing disorders, lifelong neurological disorders, nerve damage from being exposed to toxic chemicals without proper protection at the worksite. What do we know about those kinds of cases in terms of the waiting and the denial and so on? Is there any trend that we should be aware of with that?
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, President Clark, I haven't looked at it. We'll get some information together, though, and give it to members of the committee.
Thank you.
We haven't looked at that, as far as I know. If we have the information, I'm not familiar with it, we'll try to get it to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kiefer, did you have an oral amendment?
No.
It's printed.
We all got it.
Oh, we do have that now.
Yeah,
everyone's got a copy of it? Okay.
Yes.
Then I will reintroduce my oral amendment, and someone took my paperwork on it, but it's to allow for a one-time expense that the workers, thank you.
Maybe you could read it.
Okay. I'll just read it from here. From the Workers' Compensation Fund, a cost associated with implementing a case management system at the Office of Administrative Hearings. The commissioner shall appropriate a sum not to exceed $600,000 from the Special Compensation Fund for the purposes of implementing a case management system and electronic filing system at the Office of Administrative Hearings. This is a one-time appropriation. Authority to disperse these funds is granted to the Chief Administrative Law Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Is there any discussion on this amendment? Representative Scales.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm kind of curious, because the Office of Administrative Hearings does other things other than this. And what would we say the percentage of the Office Administrative Hearings business is this? Is this 10%? Is this 20%? And then would this electronic filing system be used for other tasks within the OAH that maybe should come from other funds rather than workers?
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, Assistant Chief Judge Tim O'Malley is here to answer questions, but I can tell you we've looked at it, and the system the majority of the system will be used for workers' comp. They're allocating the cost so that the workers' compensation fund will only pay for that stuff that's related to workers' compensation, to workers' comp issues, and that their other funds will pay for the remainder of the system. So the cost will be allocated properly. That's my understanding.
Representative Howes.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. First question is, where does the oral amendment go within the bill? And the second one is, do you have the money?
Commissioner Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, we have the money. This will not, every year, the Commissioner of Labor and Industry makes an assessment for the administrative costs of the workers' compensation system that pays for the workers' compensation court of appeals, the workers' comp stuff at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the workers' compensation areas at the Department of Labor and Industry. This, it's my understanding, we have not looked at it closely yet, but we'll be doing that assessment later on this summer, or I think it's August 1st, September 1st. It's my understanding that we do not believe at this time this will cause an increase in the assessment. So what we will have the money, and will not cause an increased assessment to employers.
And
I don't know.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will insert it right after line 9.31 in section 17.
Okay. Any other discussion on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion passes. Any other discussion on the bill itself? Representative Kiefer, did you want to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion to ask that House File 1362 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And again, I just want to point out that this is an important bill. We appreciate your support. It is a step in the right direction. We're not saying it's absolutely going to satisfy everyone, but we do have stakeholders from very opposite sides coming together on this bill, so we'd appreciate your support.
All those in favor of House File 1362, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. House File 1362 is passed and will be sent to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Howes. Representative Howes, did you want to move your...
Chair, I'd move House File 632 to be passed and sent to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, the reason this bill came here is because on page 7, line 15, there is a $40 fee for the maintenance plumber's license. It's not a fee increase. It's a new fee because we're creating a new license. What the maintenance... Would you like me to explain the bill, Representative Mahoney, or... Madam Chair, this bill creates a new license. It's a maintenance plumber. The simplest form to explain it would be a person can do minimum maintenance on a facility if it's owned by he or she or by their employer. They need some practical knowledge on plumbing. The only thing that we haven't solidified with the commissioner is the test that they're going to provide in them. Hoping the commissioner at some point could tell me that the test will not be a full-blown plumber's test.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe the reason Representative Howes asked me about it is because of my past involvement in codes. And my understanding is the plumbing board's actually going to develop the test and put that in front of the commissioner. And they have the rulemaking authority, and that's kind of where we've been trying to send all this. And I want to compliment you on working with the plumbing board and with all the parties involved. And, you know, I'm going to support your bill. So long as you promise never to bring another opening up the whatever, the maintenance, no, the restricted plumber's license again.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, I will make that promise if you promise when you're in the majority you will never tighten it again.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lemire.
Madam Chair, and either Representative Mahoney or Representative Howes, we don't really know what the requirement is going to be for this licensing.
Representative Howes.
Madam Chair, Representative Lemire, we don't know what the test will be. I'm hoping it'll be the same as the other one we did 2 years ago, where you basically just have to explain that you've had a couple years' experience, and that's it. I think it has to be a little bit more detailed, but I'll trust the plumbing board to come up with an examination, or maybe it could be on the application. That's what I'm hoping for.
Representative Lemire, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no problem with the concept of these facilities doing this. Having a licensed maintenance plumber. What I don't like is that they can supervise apprentices. And an apprentice could actually have more experience than a licensed maintenance plumber, especially if there's no certain rules and regulations, whether it's time being served underneath a master plumber or a journeyman plumber. I was just wondering, why was it included with all the masters and the journeymans, and then instead of just having its own little section stating that they can work on either their own property or the property of their employer?
Representative House?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Lemire, this is the way the Department of Labor and Industry works through the process, and I will continue to work with them. And when the Plumbers Board comes up with their exam, if it's not exactly what we think it should be, we'll work with them also. But this is government at its best, Representative Lemire.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lemire, what line are you looking at? What page am I?
The very first page, the term direct supervision, with respect to direct supervision of plumbing apprentice or registered unlicensed individual by a master, restricted master journeyman, restricted journeyman, and then you added or licensed maintenance plumber.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I thought I saw in the bill where it said that the unlicensed individual may not supervise an apprentice. So, and that was my understanding. And if it's not in here, I'm sure as we move this forward, I'm sure the author would be more than willing to, if the plumbing board and the department and all parties concerned, if that's an issue and that's still in here at the floor, I'm sure the author would work with you and I to keep us quiet on the floor, fix that particular problem.
Very good.
Any other questions? Would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 632 be passed with the recommendation to Ways and Means.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Nay. House File 632 is passed and will go to Ways and Means. Next, House File 611. Representative Gunther.
You might be able to just delete section one. That might take care of it.
Representative Gunther, would you like to introduce your bill?
Yes, I would, Madam Chairman. I move House File 611 to pass and go to Ways and Means. And Madam Chair and members, lack of access of capital continues to be a major barrier to growth for many small businesses. House File 611 will address the capital needs of Minnesota small businesses as they attempt to regain their footing coming out of recession. The final collapse of the 2008 financial collapse of 2008 resulted in a tightening of our credit markets, and what we're trying to do is restore them with this bill. And with that, I have some testifiers that love to inform you exactly what this bill does.
Representative Gunther, would you like to move the A1 amendment first and get it in the order you'd like?
I can find it. Yes, I would. Thank you very much.
Representative Gunther moves his A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Amendment passes. The bill's in the order you'd like. If you'd like your testifiers to proceed, please do. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Scott Martin. I'm the president of the Minnesota Community Capital Fund. We represent over 70 small cities, large cities, medium-sized cities, and counties. Local governments primarily scattered around the state probably have operations through our membership of the Community Capital Fund in all the legislative districts represented here today. The fund is a very unique source of capital for small businesses. We work in partnership with banks around the state to provide financing to small businesses, and by our definition, it's similar to the Small Business Administration's, those businesses that employ fewer than 500 people. We've had a long history of success. It was originally established in 2003, have been able to provide loans of nearly $35 million to Minnesota's small business community until the financial crisis took hold in late 2008. We were impacted directly because of our business model, and the way that we get capital in the hands of small businesses is to use a specialized secondary market that we would sell our loans to. That market continues to be on the sidelines, and without a guarantee, as proposed in the bill, we remain on the sidelines. Meanwhile, we know from the inquiries that we receive on a daily basis from working with our banking partners around the state that businesses are beginning now again to look to borrow money so that they can expand their businesses, add jobs into the economy. In fact, we have been a significant leverage of job creation over the years, with some $35 million and almost 2,400 jobs created by the borrowers of our fund. That's a leverage of one job per every $15,000 of investment made, and that's all debt investment. Whereas more typically, on a national level, the average for gap lenders like us, a gap being the amount of loan that's not that the bank's not able to provide, most gap lenders look at a leveraging of $1,000 to $50,000 per job, and ours is $1 per 15. So we've been very successful in helping small businesses over the years, and with the establishment of a 70% loan guarantee fund, a trust fund as we're proposing, we'll be back in business at a time when businesses, again, are seeking capital. We've worked with banks all around the state. Just simply, a bank will call us in to be a participant in a financing, whether any kind of business is eligible, whether it be for real estate, business equipment, refinancing of existing credit, or even working capital needs. If a bank is looking to help their customer, or even perhaps a new customer, get the financing they need, but they're either unable or unwilling to do that because of bank regulators or just plain risk management. And believe me, with the financial crisis, banks are dealing with much more heavy regulations and are much more risk adverse because of what happened in 2008. But we play a key role. We come in on a subordinated position behind the bank's loan and provide the gap in the financing so that a business can get the money they need at a fair market price. I should tell you, this is all private market driven. We are a private nonprofit corporation. Even though our members are primarily consisting of local governments, they simply have deposits with us and have that money there with no risk. It allows them to participate and for their businesses to get loans through our fund. We've done loans in the heart of the Twin Cities metro area, in the suburban communities, and in small towns all around the state. We know from talking to the secondary market that we had been doing business with in the past that with the 70% loan guarantee, money will begin to flow through us to our to the business borrowers in Minnesota. I should note, I mentioned it's a private sector initiative. Our private capital has always come from Wall Street. It's come from the big banks and the big financial institutions who would buy our loans as investments, and those investments have historically performed very well. Our loan losses until the financial crisis hit was less than 0.5%. Most banks plan for a 3-5% loss and have to have reserves of 1.5%. So the leveraging that a state loan guarantee trust fund has proposed could provide to small businesses is really, it's not infinite, but it's really significant in reopening the need for or providing capital access. I'm obviously here to answer any questions you have, but I just want to reaffirm one thing, that the state loan guarantee would be placed not on the bank's loans. It would be placed on the loans of what we're calling in the bill qualified economic development lenders, which, of course, the Minnesota Community Capital Fund is one of. But others in the state could participate in it as well, as long as they're commonly referred to as economic development lenders or GAP lenders. It's that portion, that subordinated portion of a total project financing that is in need of some support, some a government backstop, so to speak, in order to get the private capital markets back in the game with us. I do have a couple of other folks who are intimately familiar with the fund from a different perspective. First, I'd like to introduce Amy Baldwin.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Amy Baldwin. I work in economic development with the City of Brooklyn Park, and I'm also a board member on the Minnesota Community Capital Fund. The passage of this bill is important to local economic development agencies, as it will make the MCCF once again a viable resource in the toolbox for assisting businesses within our community in their growth and financing needs. The fund has assisted two companies within Brooklyn Park in the past prior to the economic downturn and capital market changes. In addition to the bank financing received by the companies, the fund was able to provide $1.3 million of financing to those companies. Based on the model of this fund, as Scott described, the city's no-risk investment in the program was only $78,000. So with that investment, we were able to make $1.3 million of loans to local businesses, and that money continually gets revolved. We believe that with the proposed guarantee, Brooklyn Park businesses would again be able to take advantage of this financing option to grow their businesses as we're coming out of this economic downturn.
Thank you, Ms. Baldwin. Any questions? Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not quite understanding exactly what this does and what it doesn't do. Could this apply to, for instance, minority construction firms often have problems with more, I guess it's not startup as much as, it's partly startup, partly working capital to cover, they may have even a state project, but it takes a while for them to get paid, and they have to pay employees, supplies. That's just one of the thoughts I had.
Representative,
it could, depending on the situation, but we do working capital loans. The key to our program is that the deal is bankable. The bank is willing to do at least 50% of the project, and they call us in to do the remainder. So it's all of our loans are collateralized. So in your example, if that contractor, we could use the equipment that they use as collateral for our loan. So short answer is yes, they would be eligible if it was a good credit otherwise.
So Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, it sounds like that would possibly be an answer to some of the problems for that. Well, Representative Gunther, you're already starting for next summer's work. Thanks.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther and Mr. Martin, is this a replica of a program in another state, or come up with it? It's going to be the first in the nation, and I mean, I like the idea. Supportive of the idea. I just was wondering where it came from.
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, it's a unique fund that we created in 2003 in Minnesota to leverage the limited resources that communities have to help small businesses, and especially, in particular, and solely in the financing area, getting access to national capital markets to bring money into small towns or all the communities in Minnesota has not been done on a comprehensive aggregated basis like it's done under the Minnesota Community Capital Fund. As far as state loan guarantee programs, we have found that some states have state loan guarantee programs, but they're all guaranteeing portions of bank loans. They're not guaranteeing the economic development piece, which is oftentimes the last money in the deal and the most difficult part of the financing to complete it. Madam Chair, if I may,
yes.
I do have just one. Some
I appreciate that. Thank you. You can identify
one
yourself.
One of our bankers.
Yes.
Okay. Hi, my name is Greg Duscher. I'm Vice President of People's Bank in Edina, and we're about a $310 million community bank focused primarily in business banking. I did sit on the Minnesota Community Fund Board for 5 years. So we've, the program that Scott has described, we have done several financial deals with our clients using the program. You know, in the last, in my 25 years of banking, the last 3 years by far have been the most difficult that we've experienced. Many businesses have failed. Many have been losing money. Many banks are struggling, struggling with classified assets, charge-offs. That we are, you know, very much scrutinized by our regulatory bodies that we report to. So what happens, the banks are pulling back, not lending a lot of money. Customers, borrowers are now coming out of this recession looking stronger. Trends are on the upswing. So it's very important to certainly community banks to have a gap lender such as this program to allow us to partner up with them to hopefully put the capital in business owners' hands to grow, add jobs, and prosper, you know, for the future. So we, as community banks, we try to partnership with cities, states, wherever we can to make the deal work.
Thank you. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I have a couple of questions. First of all, was this bill included in the omnibus jobs bill?
Representative Gunther.
Thank you,
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gunther then, and actually for Mr. Martin, I had a question. You had said prior to 2003, the loan losses had been less than 1.5% of 1%. What were they after 2003?
Mr. Martin.
After 2008. We launched the fund in 2003, so our experience in lending from 2003 to 2008, our loan loss was less than 0.5%. Subsequently, with some defaults in the portfolio, that ticked up to about 3%, still much below. I mean, we work very closely with bank lenders and try to make good lending decisions, and most of the banks in Minnesota have made good lending decisions. First of all, we don't finance vacant land, real estate development, which is really what's caused a lot of the problems. We finance growing business concerns that are looking to either create new jobs, purchase new equipment, or what have you.
Representative Scalzi.
And then, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then for Representative Gunther, on the last page of the bill, the appropriation is blank. And if you said that before, I must have missed it. But I'm wondering, that's an appropriation from the general fund. And is there money in the general fund for that? And how much?
Representative Gunther.
No, there isn't any money in the general fund. And no, there is a blank deal. This is a placeholder in case we come up with some money that we think this would be a good place to put it. So we don't have any money in it presently. That's why it's blank.
Any other discussion on the bill? Okay. So, Representative Gunther, you want to renew your motion for House File 611 to go to Commerce, is my understanding. Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay. Okay. The bill passes. Okay. House File 1170. Okay. Okay. Representative Gunther, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, the Advisory Task Force on Employee Misclassification legislative proposal for 2011 amends Minnesota Statute 181.723 and repeals the Independent Contractor Exemption Certificate program that went into effect in 2007.
and replaces it with a simplified contractor's registration. The amendment also establishes the framework within which individual construction workers may be determined to be either construction contractors or employees of construction contractors for the purpose of workers' compensation and unemployment insurance. And this is something that will put licensed contractor on a level playing field with people that aren't licensed contractors. And with that, I would love to have...
Would you like to move the bill first?
I would move House File 1170 to pass and be sent on to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Okay. If you could identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Jessica Lumen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry for the Construction Codes Licensing and Labor Standards Division. This bill actually is a proposal, as Representative Gunther says, of the Advisory Task Force on Misclassification of Workers in the Construction Industry. The Advisory Task Force was established by this legislature in 2009 and is made up of individuals representing commercial and residential construction, general contractors, subcontractors, independent contractors, construction employees, as well as representatives from Labor and Industry, Department of Revenue, DEED, and the Attorney General's Office. The group met for over a year, had 11 different meetings. As you can imagine, when you bring that group together, much like the Workers' Compensation Council, that there are a lot of differing opinions in the room about how to solve very difficult issues. This bill is one of the recommendations of that group. The task force is charged with presenting a report to the legislature at the end of this session, but this is one of the proposals and wanted to bring it before you now. The other recommendations include increased coordination of enforcement activities, as well as continued education of the construction industry, both of which will be facilitated through this bill as well. The Advisory Task Force Independent Contractor Exemption determined that the Independent Contractor Exemption Certificate program just wasn't working as we had hoped it would and intended that it would. It was a really good idea that, unfortunately, was not as effective as we had hoped it would have been in eliminating the misclassification of workers on construction projects. Therefore, under this proposal, we've removed the Independent Contractor Exemption Certificate and instead created this simplified registration program. Anybody who's not otherwise licensed by the department and then therefore already provided information to the department would need to register as a construction contractor in the state. There is a fee to register just like there are with other licenses at the department. This is an $80 biannual fee, which would be required of everyone who's registering. This is 50% lower than the $165 that were required to get an independent contractor exemption certificate. Registration will be done online. Public data will be easier for contractors and homeowners to look up and make sure that they're, if they're working with a licensed and or registered contractor. Contractors will have to provide their business names, names and social security numbers of owners and officers of LLCs and corporations, and proof of workers' compensation and unemployment insurance where required. This kind of information is the information that's critical for enforcement of misclassification issues. And is important to DLI as well as DEED as well as revenue. And it's the same information that's required of licensed residential contractors, electrical contractors, okay, bonded plumbers, and other individuals who are performing construction work in the state of Minnesota. The nine-factor test, as you might have heard referred to, which is the historic test that the Workers' Compensation Division has always used in order to establish whether or not someone should be covered by workers' compensation or not, it's this nine-factor test to establish the employer-employee relationship, was put into the Independent Contractor Exemption Certificate law. It is maintained here as part of the registration construction contractor definition. Under this proposal, business entities and individual owners and officers are required to have business practices that actually identify them as construction contractors. They have active filings with the Secretary of State, operate under written contracts and invoices, and make the payments for construction services to entities and not to individuals, unless those individuals are, in fact, employees. There's also a creation of penalties for a failure to register, to hire a contractor who's not registered, and also for coercing people into becoming a business entity when they are actually employees. There are, I believe, some members of the advisory task force that are here and may wish to speak to the proposal. Again, like to congratulate the task force on their very hard work in order to bring this forward. As you can imagine, it's consensus, but not necessarily. It's not the silver bullet, and the advisory task force recognizes that it's one more tool in order to try to address a very difficult issue.
Thank you, Ms. Luhmann. Would you like to testify?
No. Madam Chair, my name is Charlie Durenberger. I'm the Enforcement Services Manager of the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, and I'm just here to answer any questions that may come up relating to enforcement.
Okay, thank you. Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gunther, this is a lot better. I still see one spot where maybe people can dance around this. With all due respect to carpenters, there are some companies, home remodelers, that still hire carpenters based on, they just give them a flat amount of money, let's put it that way. The contractor would buy all the lumber and material, buy all the windows, buy all the everything to do with it, right down to the nails. Is there still a way that this tightens up so that carpenter crew, as we call it, would still have to register as an independent contractor, or would they still be able to kind of skirt the system?
Mr. Durenberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, so what you're asking is whether those workers who are just basically providing the labor can be independent contractors, or are you saying that they should be employees? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Representative Howes.
Madam Chair, they should be employees under the way they are working, because they are directed when to be there, what time to start, how to put it together, etc. But if they're not employees, then does this help us? Does this make them independent contractors and recognized as such?
Mr. Durenberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Powell, the way this would work is if those individuals are not registered, then they're presumed to be employees. In order to be a construction contractor, those people would have to be registered with us if they want to be independent contractors, and they still have to meet the nine-factor test. So if they're not meeting the nine-factor test and they are registered, then part of our job would be to investigate that relationship, and if we find that they're not meeting the nine-factor test, then they're employees.
Well, Madam Chair, to explain this better, blank construction company does gives you a new garage, gives you a brand new dining room on the back of your house. They buy all the lumber, bring everything in there. They've got a salesman. They got the whole nine yards. They have a crew come in and put all the lumber together, but they're not employees. They work separately, and they are given a check, and at the end of the year, they get a 1099. But they've never registered with you. They're below the radar, so to speak.
Mr. Durenberger.
Madam Chair, Representative Howes, if that's the case and they're not registered and we find out that they're actually doing that, then they are, by definition, employees of that general contractor that brought them over there.
Well, then, Madam Chair, why aren't the employers paying their workers' comp, their unemployment insurance, and everything else? Because this happens every day. This hasn't changed. It's still going on.
Mr. Durenberger.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Howes, I mean, that's part of the enforcement that we're doing right now. And right now, the situation with those individuals would be, if they're individuals and they don't have an ICEC, then they're deemed to be employees of the contractor that brought them to that job site. And we're citing those people, and we're referring the information that we develop in our investigations to revenue and to deed. But what's happening in the real world is, there aren't any individuals out there anymore. Everybody that's on this job site that you're proposing has formed an LLC now. And so they now operate as LLCs. And the courts have held that an LLC cannot be an employee of another business entity. So that's part of what we're trying to get at with the registration is, when the ICEC law went into effect, everybody saw that it applied only to individuals. So the easy way around it for both employers and for the workers that don't necessarily want to be employees is that you form an LLC. And so now you don't have to be covered for workers' comp. You don't have to be covered for unemployment. You can get paid cash. You can have checks made out to you, to your company. You can cash them at a check cashing place. And there's no way to trace where all this money is going. And so what we're trying to do with this now with registration is these people, if they are LLCs now, they're going to have to be registered with us, and they're going to have to disclose who they are, where they are, and give us information that will be useful for us for effective enforcement, not only with Labor and Industries, but with the Department of Employment and Economic Development and with the Department of Revenue.
Madam Chair, just a short follow-up.
Representative House.
I don't want to take all the committee's time, but there needs to be a way to track those still, whether it be every time a building permit is issued, your office is notified that there's said contractor working there. But in the 30 years I've done this, I've never seen anybody from the Department of Labor, the unemployment, from anywhere, except the only ones I've seen that are rare, someone from OSHA, and that's very rare. I see a union rep come around once in a while. I see a building inspector, but never, ever in my 30 years have I seen somebody from the Department of Labor come and ask me if I'm a real contractor or just a scab.
Did you want to respond? Or?
He doesn't have to.
Okay. Ms. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this a two-year registration, or why is the revenue so volatile?
Madam Chair, Representative
Ms. Lohman.
Thank you. It is a two-year registration, which is the same as our licensing cycle. Under the ICEC piece of it, it had initially been an annual registration, but it has been expanded into a biannual registration to mirror the rest of our licensing and registration licensing programs at the department. And again, we've established a general practice of a biannual fee, and this fits right along with our biannual fees at the $80 biannually.
Looks like we have a new testifier. Would you like to speak now, or?
Hi. Good afternoon. Hi, my name is Chris Levine. I saw that this was being presented today, and I kind of did a short notice to be here. A few years ago, I got involved with the independent contract exemption certificate and saw it as a good opportunity to provide good tax dollars to the state, make sure that our employees are getting proper workers' compensation insurance and state unemployment. Excuse me. What ended up happening is everybody formed LLCs, and we all know that. The registration was tremendous. Everybody figured out a different way of doing something and getting around it. Due to Larry's concern, one of the things that we can do is enforce this through the task force by providing a system through the MWCIA, which is the Workers' Compensation Rating Bureau that goes ahead and puts policies in place for if any policies that go to Berkeley or RTW. We have a very good system out there through audit systems through workers' comp that would be a part of this. I think this bill is in the right direction. It's very cumbersome. What was there before and what we have today is correct. We just need to put a better task force plan in place with what we have already. So I'm in favor of this to simplify things, but I definitely have some ideas with the task force that we can help improve a much more better, smoother way of doing things. And so I'm for this to simplify it, and but there's definitely some things that we can help to prevent what Larry is talking about to make things run more smoothly.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Are you a member of the advisory committee or a citizen, or what's your capacity today?
I own a company called Employer Solutions Group. We work with companies in the construction trade industry to help them with a lot of their back office administration items and some of the challenges that they see by other non-construction or construction contractors that are not treating their employees as employees has been a very big challenge. As this certificate, independent contractor certificate, went in place, I saw a tremendous amount of our clients going ahead and moving into a way of not doing the right thing. And it's been a big challenge. It's not good for the employees because they need to have that access to workers' comp, their right, as well as state unemployment. And that bill did not give them that opportunity. This is cleaning it up. It's moving in the right direction, but there's a better way of policing it, definitely.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
In the interest of time, I won't ask for an explanation right here, but if you could pass your cards, if I could get your contact information, because my one question, I now have your card, my one question to anyone on the committee at the witness table is, you know, lawyers are really typically really smart people, and there's an awful lot more of them than there probably should be. And we thought we had this thing done with the independent contractor registration. We really did. And a lot of smart lawyers got together and figured out a way around the law. And you know, whether it's the way they should be done, they got actually paid for it, so I guess it's the right thing to do. But it really irks me. So my question is, I would like to sit down and talk with you to figure out your particular items. We tend to put these task force together, and we go to the lowest common denominator oft times on task force to keep everybody happy. So expect a phone call, because
thank
I would
you. Yep, thank you.
I'd like to talk to you about
thank
that.
You.
Okay.
Any Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe if one of the testifiers could just work out a scenario. I'm trying to figure out how this might impact. On page 2 of the bill, 2.8, and also line 2.15, it pulls out a particular construction cleaning services in 2.8. And so a lot of times there's post-construction cleanup. You know, they buff up the toilets and vacuum the carpet and they clean the windows. So this says construction services does include construction cleaning services, but then later on here, well, line 2.10 says construction services do not include, and then cleaning or maintenance of a building. So how does that impact? I'm familiar with a couple different kind of post-construction cleaning companies. There's either like a Janipro or a Service Master, and they're a real company, and they have real direct employees, actual employees, or there might be someone who's just doing that, like a 1099, and they're just a person. How would this legislation impact those two scenarios, and are these at odds with each other?
Ms. Luhmann.
Madam Chair, Representative, this was something that this definition and this portion of it was something that the task force worked very, very hard on in terms of trying to encompass what actually is construction services, which is not. And you've identified one of the things that they struggled with very much. The general understanding that we reached was that construction services include the final cleanup, if you will, that are covered under the construction contract before the project's turned over to the owner. What is not included is the janitorial services that may be contracted directly by the owner, not related to construction services. And so that was the distinction that's trying to be made in this language.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gunther, did you want to renew your motion?
Madam Chairman, I think there might be somebody else who would like to testify.
Would anybody else like to testify? Please come forward if you'd like to testify.
Did you? Okay,
No, it sounds like no one does.
Okay, great. With that, I will renew my motion to have House File...
Number 1170.
Okay, Madam Chairman, before it goes to Ways and Means, committee administrator says we have to discuss the fee that someone can work to without having to be licensed. And the Builders Association of Minnesota said they would like $600. The average state around us is $2,000. And I think of my friendly little school teachers that go paint houses. It wouldn't be long that they would be past the $600. So I think the committee should help me decide which is the appropriate type of figure. Is there any discussion on that?
Is that in the bill then? Or?
It's on page 4, section 8. There's a blank space there. Line 4.16.
What would you like to recommend?
I personally like to recommend $2,000.
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Gunther, you said one of the other people from the task, one of the other groups from the task force had a figure in mind?
The Builders Association of Minnesota has a figure of $600 in mind.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Could you, do you have an understanding as to why, or does Mr. Lohman have an understanding to Ms. Why, or, here comes a testifier. Someone would like to say why?
I did everything but invite her down here.
You could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Good afternoon, members. My name is Pam Perry. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. My members participated in this task force, and we're certainly supportive of making sure that there's enough enforcement around this issue, because we would agree with the task force members that there is a lot of confusion about the misclassification of employees. However, when the committee discussed this threshold of what should an employer have to report, we wanted it to be consistent with the way we report our 1099s. We are required to report all income that we pay to independent contractors or anyone else over $600. So it doesn't seem reasonable to put arbitrary numbers in the statute that aren't consistent with what federal law is already requiring us. So we would respectfully ask you to consider $600 so it's consistent with what we have to report on our 1099s. That was our position on this portion of the bill.
Just wondering, Mr. Durenberger, do you have any comment on this?
Madam Chair, the comment that I would make today, and it's the comment that I made throughout all the meetings of the advisory task force, is that the higher the number that you set for this threshold, the more difficult it will be for enforcement purposes. Because when we do actually go out to job sites and we identify workers on these job sites, and if we're going to ask them if they're registered with us, they're going to say, don't have to be. I didn't make $2,000 last year, $5,000, $10,000, whatever the amount's going to be. And so the burden would be on us to prove that that individual did receive more than that threshold in payments from other contractors in that year, and that would be extremely difficult without the authority that we would have under the the authority that we have now, which would also be enhanced with this bill. So that's why the argument generally that I would make is, from an enforcement standpoint, the higher the number for this threshold, the more difficult enforcement will be.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Madam Chair, and I will go against the chair's recommendation, and I will make a motion for $600 on line, on page 4, line 16, and I'll give my reasoning here. Is that if we're trying to keep simplicity for business at a 1099 at $600, let them be able to keep records on a consistent basis, and the easier I can make it for Mr. Durenberger and his employees to enforce this, the simpler, the better off we are. So I hope the chair will take that with a grain of salt.
Representative Gunther.
I certainly will. I also believe that the large contractors wanted to be $12,000 to $15,000. So I thought my $2,000 was kind of really in the conservative side of the two. And I don't think any summer employment would be less than $2,000. So that was my consideration.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think, I mean, if it's going to be 600, it might as well be, in my mind, I'm just thinking, you might as well make it $0 or $1. I can't imagine anything on a construction site, a job to be done, where you would have receipts of, I mean, anything you would do would gross $600. So, I mean, that's a really low number. I mean, if one wants 12,000 and one wants 600, I mean, yeah, it just seems to be, I mean, I just think we need to know that that's, in essence, what we're doing, whether you agree with that or not.
What would you like to do? Any other discussion? Did you want to keep that?
Madam Chair and members, again, it's, you know, this is good. Hubert Humphrey, Democrat, trying to help out small local contractors, and the only reason that I see it as a consistency across the 1099, and if we're going to add another layer of paper, another system of record keeping to a level, I don't know that 2,000 or 12,000 would make a difference. It's really trying to keep it simple, but I mean, if I won't feel offended if people vote against it, but may as well vote for the 600, then we can go with the chairs.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification. Do we need to actually put an appropriation in, or do we just need to discuss it? Does an appropriation have to be in to go to Ways and Means?
My understanding is we have to have something in there. Representative Gunther.
It's my understanding the Senate's got $600 in it, which doesn't necessarily make it right.
So we have a motion on the table to by Representative Mahoney to insert in line 4.16 the number 600. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
Wow.
May fail.
It fails. Thank you. So, shall we try the 2,000? I can't make the motion, I guess.
Madam Chairman, I move that we put insert 2,000 in the blank space in line 4.16.
Okay. Any discussion? Representative Gunther moves $2,000 be inserted in line 4.16. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay? It is there. Okay. So your bill is in the way you'd like it, so you want to...
I would move it passes and goes to Ways and Means.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill passes. House File 1396. Representative Gunther, would you like to introduce your House File 1396?
Madam Chairman, I move that House File 1396 be approved and passed and sent to Ways and Means.
Okay. Please proceed.
Members, House File 1396 is a UI bill and it saves employers $20 million in 2012, simplifies the initial qualifying requirements for UI benefits, Articles 1, Section 4, and treats personal time off pay paid at layoffs the same as vacation pay and paid at the time of layoff. Simplifies and requalifies requirements to collect UI benefits after quitting, Article 1, Section 7, and adds to the definition of dislocated worker. A dislocated worker is an individual covered under the Federal Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, workers laid off due to imports, Article 3, Section 1. And with that, we have several amendments. We will start out with the A2 amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Gunther moves his A2 amendment.
This is a technical amendment. Weekly unemployment benefits amount means the amount of unemployment benefits computed under sections 268.07 and pardon me?
Any questions on the A2 amendment?
And if you have any questions, leave which lamp.
No questions. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment passes.
Okay, the second amendment is probably the more contentious of the amendments. There are definite lines in the sand on this one. It is an amendment that the staffing and temps bring forward and talks about suitable employment is a reason why someone would not get unemployment benefits if they don't have suitable employment, and that it's got a definition statute that Lee can kind of tell us about.
Mr. Nelson, did you want to speak to this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will just speak to current law. Last legislative session in a conference committee was came to the current provision, which says that if an individual is offered a job with a temporary health agency, essentially, it is suitable only if you have a past history of working with temporary help industry. You had to have a certain amount of past wages in your last year for that work to be considered suitable. And again, you can only be denied benefits by refusing a suitable job. So therefore, if you're offered a job with a temporary help industry, current law provides you have to, for it to be suitable, you had to have a past history of working in a temp agency. This would repeal that provision of the law which was put in last year.
Are there any questions?
No, go ahead.
Representative Mallory.
Isn't more protective of the worker the way it is right now?
Mr. Nelson?
He's opposed.
Pardon me?
I guess I was asking Mr. Nelson, isn't the present law more protective of the worker that they won't end up losing unemployment comp that they maybe should get?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulrig, the particular provision currently in place would allow a worker to turn down a temporary job unless they've had a past history of working in temporary help work. That's current law. This particular amendment would repeal that. So people would be denied benefits if they turned down temporary work, so long as it was otherwise suitable. Current law provides just a monetary threshold of how much past history you have to have for it to be suitable. And this would repeal that bright line monetary rule.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gunther and Mr. Nelson. This provision was put in last year, and it had come through the, I believe this provision that's in law that this amendment attempts to take out went through the UI originally last year, 2 years ago. Didn't it come through? It did not.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, this particular provision did not come through the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. The current law did not. This was brainchild of Representative Obermueller last year, and was ultimately worked out in conference committee last year. I will tell you this, the department did not propose this legislation. We opposed this legislation last year, because it had not gone through the advisory council. We'll see, currently we can't support this amendment for the very same reason. Again, we have a process we'd like to follow, and this the amendment also did not go through that process. We would like all legislation so we can have a better vetting, bring all the interest groups together, try to reach a consensus on anything. And last year, this did not go through the advisory council, nor did this particular amendment go through the advisory council this year.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
So it had a year to be discussed, the ramifications of this new law. It had a year to be discussed in the unemployment council, and it was not. Could you tell me and the committee, has this the pluses and minuses of this particular provision that was put into law last year, has it worked? Has it helped unemployed people? Has it hindered the temporary agencies that fought very hard against this last year?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, this law has been in effect since July 1st of 2010, so we do not have a lot of experience with it. As to the actual net effect, I can tell you what the effect is. Our statistics, and they're not real good yet because we don't have, you know, that much of a snapshot, only a few months worth actually, is that it makes it, quite frankly, easier to administer, because you look at a case, and if a person doesn't have a past history, the case is over. If they have a past history, then you have to go through a much more in-depth analysis. Now, what would the actual result have been at the bottom, at the end of the day? That's still unclear. I don't know that the statistics bear out one way or the other that, you know, this law means a whole lot more workers are going to collect, or this law means, you know, a lot more workers aren't. What the net effect is, our analysis doesn't reach to any conclusion yet because we don't have enough time. But we do know it makes the law a whole lot easier to administer because, again, you just look at a case. If they don't have a certain amount of past wages in the temp industry, the case is over. But if they do, now what result would be, we don't know. So we don't know what that result would have been otherwise had we looked at the analysis. They may still have, workers still may still have been paid. And I don't know that the statistics are quite sufficient yet to reach a conclusion what the real impact of this particular law is.
Thank you. It appears we have about three testifiers that have come forward on this issue. If you could keep it brief, we'd appreciate it. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jean Haven, and I am an employee of Vision Staffing Solutions. We're a member of the Minnesota Recruiting and Staffing Association. I've been employed in this industry for 22 years, and I'd like to give you a quick snapshot of who we are. We're not temporary agencies. We are employers who put people to work in the state of Minnesota. We're on the front line partnering with you to put them back to work, and we work with businesses who rely on our expertise to recruit, hire, sometimes train, and staff a variety of positions that may be temporary or short-term. They may also be long-term to cover a medical leave or some other peak season. And there's an internal terminology called temp to hire or trial for hire, where businesses will look to us to assist them in finding the talent that will fill their long-term need. And we're here today because this language does adversely impact our bottom line and affects the staffing industry greatly. And Cindy sits on the advisory council. I'll let Cindy introduce herself.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
As she said, my name is Cindy Brooks. I've worked at Dolphin Staffing for nearly 14 years. As Jean, I deal with this all the time. Basically, what I would say about this language is that we're really looking to have it taken out completely. You know, there's been some talk at just reducing the percent, and that's really not what we're looking for. We really want it out of there. We think that it should at least be reviewed in the advisory council. I know also it wasn't heard in the Senate. It was just kind of dropped in, and no opportunity for the effects on our industry to even be reviewed. So what we would like to see is it taken out and be fixed.
Thank you for your testimony. I think there's someone else that wanted to speak. Please identify yourself and then proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and we represent low-income families across the state. I also sit on the UI Advisory Council. Just one note, as they said, this new language last year didn't go through the UI Advisory Council, and this particular amendment also didn't go through the UI Advisory Council last year, and I think this is probably a bad practice that we're getting into in terms of not letting all groups weigh in. But we are opposed to this amendment, and I just want to, before I tell you why we're opposed, I'd like to share Legal Aid's experience with temp agencies and temp jobs. I know that the staffing industry is trying very hard to change their image, to be known as a staffing industry, to have, they have told us that the majority of their jobs are temp to hire, are trial jobs, and I do appreciate that. But I wouldn't be sitting here today if there weren't hundreds, possibly thousands of jobs across the state that are temp jobs. And they're not very good jobs. They're low pay, they're no benefit, and on Friday, I spent the better part of Friday afternoon looking through temp job listings on the internet for some of the agencies we have across the state. And just to give you an example of a couple from Dolphin, it's called Indro Tech. I think that might be a subdivision of Dolphin. You know, one of these jobs is, it's in Anoka. You have to be able to work any shift. You have to be able to work mandatory overtime. You have to be able to spend the entire shift standing. It pays $10 an hour. And there's a little caveat in here that says occasional exposure to risk of electric shock. And this is a light industrial assembly position. So these jobs aren't really, I'm not talking about paralegals. I'm not talking about medical technology positions. We're talking about a very significant number of jobs across the state that are not great jobs. And what happens is we have low-income people or low-wage workers who take a job with the staff. They've lost a job. They've been laid off. They take a temp job. And a lot of these jobs say that they're temp to hire, or they say this job has the potential to become a permanent position. And so a worker takes that job, and then our experience is with 90 to 100% of the people that we see, unpredictably, that job ends and they're laid off. They're laid off after a month, 2 months, could be a few weeks. And then they have 5 days to call into the temporary staffing agency, say they've been laid off, and they have to accept another assignment from the temp agency. If they don't accept that assignment from the temp agency, it makes them ineligible for unemployment. That's what the prior law was. What the current law says is if you haven't worked a majority of your time in the staffing agency or temp agencies in the past, you shouldn't be forced to take another temp agency job. Your unemployment shouldn't be held hostage by whether or not you're willing to take a temp job. We have, to those of you who are employers and small business employers, if you have two candidates' resumes sitting in front of you, and John has worked 2 years at the same factory, and Jason has worked 8 factories in 2 years, I can guarantee I know which one you're going to look more favorably upon. There's a heavy stigma with taking a series of temp agency jobs, and our clients know that. Our clients want permanent, stable jobs. And we think that, when you look through these job listings, most of them do say temp to hire. They say possibility for permanent employment. And our clients, I think it's deceptive. And I think our clients take these jobs because they hope that they'll turn into something permanent. And then they're laid off. And then, for instance, we just had a client last week who started in manufacturing. Then she had to take a crossing guard job. And then she had to take another factory job. And these jobs, they were short jobs. They were 3-4 months. And so the jobs are unpredictable, and I think I'm using up my time. So I appreciate I appreciate the opportunity to testify, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Leidiger, if we could be brief.
My questions have been answered
okay,
already.
Okay, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I guess I didn't know that people were eligible for unemployment if they worked, say, a month and then were laid off and had to take another job. So this is all new to me. Being an employer who pays unemployment insurance, this is very enlightening to me. So who then pays the unemployment when I'm assuming that Dolphin or Temp to Hire or Trial to Hire pays unemployment into the system for your people that you place. Is that correct?
That is correct. Basically, when somebody is not going to accept another position, then yes, we would pay their unemployment. I would like to respond, if I could, to
briefly.
Oh, thank you. All right. To what she had to say. I guess that what I'd want to explain is that we have the same expectations as any other employer, meaning if somebody is going to leave employment with us, we'd like the opportunity to replace their position. and we do train them. She's talking about one position, and it's with our light industrial company. She's not talking about the professional sector of staffing companies. So, I mean, what we would be looking for if somebody wanted to leave us is the opportunity to replace the position. That's what we need to do with our client. Somebody just not, you know, just leaving doesn't leave us in a good situation.
Well, and Madam Chair and members of the committee, when they are listing on their resume 8 factory jobs, they really don't need to be doing that. If they're employed by Vision Staffing Solutions, we may have sent them out on a number of assignments, but their employer of record is Vision Staffing Solutions, and they may have worked for us for 12 years in a variety of temporary positions or long-term positions where they've had an opportunity to build skills and have a bridge to full-time traditional permanent work.
Thank you. We need to continue on. Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, to say that this had no vetting is a little unfair because I watched Representative Overmuller talk endlessly and meet endlessly with the staffing agencies. And endlessly, I think he worked more on this particular provision than I worked on the Angel Tax Credit last year. And I worked 100 or better hours on the Angel Investment Tax Credit. So I have a little point of contention with your no vetting on this particular piece. I won't go into some of the other parts of it. I have a question for Mr. Nelson or for the legal aid person. One of the problems that came up last year that was brought up time and time again is that people get caught in a vicious cycle of only being able to work in the temporary agencies because they get caught in this. They have to come back. They have to come back. They have to come back. And my question is that, did I hear that correctly from Mr. Overmuller, Representative Overmuller last year, or from yourself, or from the, whoever it was that spoke to that last year?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chairman, that can be the case, and that's why, one of the reasons I know that you're speaking with Representative Overmuller,
you speak up.
That you pursued this particular legislation, which basically says you can get out of that cycle if you don't have a past history, so that you can try out working in your temp job. And you're in that cycle only if you've worked for quite a while in those temp jobs. But once you just start it and you want to get out of it, you can. And that was one of his things. You can do it without consideration. You can walk away from a temp job. And that was part of the purpose of this legislation last year. But again, the department did not support the legislation because it didn't go through our advisory council last year. And that's why we don't support this particular amendment, because again, it didn't go through our advisory council this year. So we cannot support the amendment.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would like to amend the A1 amendment. On page 2, line 21, I'll remove all the strikeouts first, and then on page line 221 and 223, strike out 45 and insert 25.
Okay. In line 2.21, strike 45 and insert 25. And on line 223, strike 45 and insert 25. Any discussion to that?
Remove all the stricken language.
And remove all the stricken language.
Reinstate.
I'm sorry. Reinstate the language on lines 2.20 to 2.26. Any discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, could you explain it, what it does?
Ms. Newman is going to confirm what the actual amendment is.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 2, line 17, delete the new language.
Line 17 or line 21?
Page 2, line 17, so delete the new language. Page 2, line 19, reinstate the stricken language. And page 2, lines 20 through 26, reinstate the stricken language. And then page 2, line 21, delete 45 and insert 25. Page 2, line 23, delete 45 and insert 25.
Any discussion to that motion? Representative Scalzi.
So, thank you, Ms. Chair. So that I'm assuming that the office is not in favor of this because it didn't go through the process of the unemployment task force. Correct?
Just did.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi. The department cannot support any amendment that hasn't gone through our advisory council. To that extent, I guess that's a comment. We can't support it.
Okay. It's my understanding,
Representative Gunther.
It's my understanding that this is a big step towards peace in the valley in this issue. And those people that were vehemently against it are now at least neutral. So both sides have come together in an area where they can accept it and move on.
Okay, we're going to vote on the oral amendment to the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment to the amendment passes. Now to the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The A1 amendment passes.
Pass amendment.
Any other discussion to the House File 1396? Any other testifiers to House File 1396? Okay. Would you like to renew your motion?
I remove my motion to have House File 1396 be passed and sent to means as amended.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The bill passes. Meeting is adjourned.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Clark.
I just want to make an announcement. I just passed around a document that's an invitation to a reception from the Minnesota Community Land Trust Coalition. Okay. And it has to do with our housing issues, and so I wanted to make sure everybody knew that the committee is especially invited. It's tomorrow, the 13th.
Thank you,
at the Sheraton, Minneapolis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative.